Welcome to Alternative Realities, a podcast about the people, strategies, and stories driving the world of alternative investments. I'm Aaron Mulvihill, and my guest today is Bill Egan, head of the Absolute Return and Opportunistic Fixed Income team at JP Morgan Asset Management. With inflation expectations on the rise, volatility is back, and stocks and bonds are increasingly moving together. This is driving interest in uncorrelated and absolute return strategies that can generate returns regardless of what's happening with broader market beta or the economy. On today's episode, we'll discuss where an absolute return strategy fits in portfolios, some areas of opportunity that Bill is seeing in the market, and some thoughts on where we are in today's credit cycle, including private credit. I always enjoy my conversations with Bill, so let's get right into it. Bill, thanks very much for coming on Alternative Realities.
Yes, thanks for having me.
So before we start, I'd love to hear some background on yourself, your career, and your role here at JP Morgan Asset Management.
Yes, well, my career started way back in 1990, and I was a finance major in school, and I decided fixing was always very interesting to me because of the mathematics behind it, and that's a mathematically bound asset class. It made a lot of sense to me. So I got into structured investment management to start. I started managing GICs at Cigna Investments when I got out of school. I did that for a few years, then moved over to Fidelity Investments, where I ran a fund that really focused on four key areas and moving around four key areas of the fixed income markets, including emerging market debt, high yield, sovereign debt, effectively, and as well as U.S. government debt, which are the major sectors of the fixed income
food groups.
Yeah.
And that worked out well. It was a great fund. I ran it until 2005. And then I made the decision that long-only investing really wasn't for me. And part of it was because the wonderful thing about fixed income is the mathematics are known. Mm-hmm. Like you pretty much can dictate how much return is available in fixed income markets based on where interest rates are, where spread levels are. And that was an exciting concept to me because I always wanted to run a fund that could really do anything in fixing them, go long, go short, put on relative value trades, utilize both cash markets and synthetic markets. And I got that opportunity and I left Fidelity and went to Highbridge Capital and launched a hedge fund there, which ultimately, grew to a few billion dollars and was pretty popular. And it was a go anywhere fixed income discipline that could, literally go anywhere, do anything, both on the long side and the short side. So not just a flexible bond product, but literally flexibility personified. It can do anything long, can do anything short. Wherever the opportunities are, we can target them. And if we can't find good opportunities that are backed up by the mathematics behind fixed income, then maybe we should be positioned very conservatively until such time as those opportunities show up. Now, the idea came from JP Morgan, who was an owner of Highbridge Capital at the time, that, hey, it seems like you could do this in a mutual fund format, couldn't you?
So absolute return fund. Can you talk a little bit about where does an absolute return fund fit into a portfolio?
Yeah, no, it's a great question to ask. The key thing that people need to remember about a true absolute return discipline is that, number one, it requires really a lot of focus, a lot of dedication. It really should be the only thing you do because it's such a complicated opportunity set. And if your pure focus is on consistently beating the risk-free rate at all times, sometimes by a lot, sometimes by a little, all depending on what the opportunity set has to offer, you have to be very vigilant about that.
So when you look at a lot of bond funds, they tend to be correlated to treasuries, they tend to be correlated to each other.
Yes.
How do you achieve an uncorrelated strategy? And can you give me maybe some examples of areas of the market you go into to get this lack of correlation?
So it can come from many, many different sources. The fact that, our investment universe is wide open. Like we've historically bought anything from closed-end funds to ETFs to traditional high-yield securities, all forms of credit, securitized, non-securitized, treasury
times. You can really go anywhere.
Oh, truly go anywhere. And the wonderful thing about it is the mathematics dictate what we're going to do. Like, for instance, today, spreads are extremely tight. So you don't get much more for taking credit risk than you do on owning treasuries, right? In fact, you're getting paid the least amount for default risk right now in the market than you ever have been in history. That, to me, is not an opportunity, right? The math doesn't dictate it. I don't want it. So right now, I'm positioned very conservatively. So I'm focused on the very front end of the yield curve. I think 2 years in is a fine place to be. That's part of the reason why we don't look like everyone else, so we're not going to be correlated like everyone else. Now, there are short periods of time Where we do have correlation, that's close to the market.
And so we're recording this on May 20th because the world is changing very, very quickly.
And we'll change with it. If you're going to run absolute return correctly, your modeling better be good. Your risk modeling better be good. The way you approach the opportunity set, your trading abilities better be good. And you better be able to utilize a wide swath of different investments because in many cases, like even now, you know, you see what's going on with, for instance, business development companies performing terribly, but the rest of the credit world is performing great. Right. So you have this mini bear market going on, which, by the way, is a signal to me that, you know, this never happens in isolation. At some point, it catches up elsewhere, which signals to me that we're very near the end of the credit cycle because it's been 10 years since we had one. But even in situations like that, we'll look to take advantage of idiosyncratic trades that are happening in any space that's getting hit. A few years ago, I think you remember with AT1s, which are contingent convertible bonds issued by European banks. Those got hit like you wouldn't believe 3 years ago. You know, in some cases, your securities are going from par to 50 cents on the dollar in a matter of months.
So how do you react to a situation, an opportunity, or how do you look at something like that example?
Well, so number one is we make sure we have expertise across all areas of the firm. If we don't have them in-house, we utilize resources across the firm, whether it's in our fixed income division, whether it's in our equity division, whether it's in our alts division. And so that's the one thing about this fund. It's very resource intensive. I mean, it's all we do. And that's really what absolute return deserves. It can't be a side hustle. Mm. It can't be something you just say you do on the side. There are an awful lot of funds back in the day, and I'm sure you remember this, that used to call themselves absolute return
strategy, a true alternative strategy. Yep. Did it really have lack of correlation with public markets?
Exactly, which is really important for fixed income investors, because the one thing about a number of fixed income investors, they hold a lot of funds that are very highly correlated with each other, and they don't realize it until such time as it costs them. It costs them money to find out that what they held was way too correlated.
So you mentioned the credit cycle. Where do you think we are right now in the credit cycle? And how are you looking at underwriting standards, spreads being tight? What is that signaling to you?
Yeah, it's very late in the credit cycle. And there's a lot of signaling I'm seeing right now that is very similar to other ends of credit cycles. I see we haven't had one in 10 years. The last one we had was really 2016, which was led by energy names. You remember that was when oil went straight down. You technically had negative futures prices on oil for a little while. So all the energy names in the index, which were a decent component in the high yield index, really got hit. And you saw spreads in the high yield market widen out from like 300 over, which at the time was a record tight, all the way up to 1,000. But this time it's probably going to be led by technology, which is an increasingly high portion of the credit markets, particularly recently, where you have, like, you know, for instance, what is $300 to $400 billion of AI-related issuance this year? So it's not coming out of cash flow, or now it's debt issuance, right? And a lot of it is in the form of SPVs, you know, special purpose vehicles, and, you know, kind of opaque structures to, you know, get debt off the balance sheet or to make a balance sheet appear better than they actually are. A lot of the credit demand is coming from known sources, which are always reliable. Like, for instance, a lot of credit usage is coming from some of these insurance companies that are captively held by some of the large private credit firms. And, you know, again, there's some implied leverage there, and some of the liabilities are ceded off to reinsure. So it's created this kind of artificial demand loop in my mind, very similar to the revenue recognition model for a lot of the AI companies, which is they call circular revenue. Okay. Because, you know, for instance, one company, I'm not going to name companies, one company, you know, makes an equity investment in an AI company. That AI company in return buys, a, you know, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars of chips from company A, the originating company, who then in turn goes and spends that on, you know, on data centers and data center, you know, the insides of data centers, I say rack storage, et cetera.
Yep.
And there's a whole thing about obsolescence relative to that, which we'll talk about later. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, it's just not, the math is telling you that, you know, credit is fully valued, right, at the end of the day. And yet the demand for credit is incredibly high, even at these. So if I were a company, I'd be issuing as much debt as I could right now, right? Because the fever is there. And that, to me, when underwriting standards get that easy and when spreads get that tight, that's your primary signal that you're nearing the end of the credit cycle. And so, yes, I think we're very, very close.
And what's interesting is spreads are getting tight on the public and the private side.
So yeah, 100%.
What are your thoughts on private credit?
Yeah, so private credit, as you've seen, and I've been talking about this for about a year, you've seen clearly the cracks in private credit right now. Like, private credit, I think the way it was sold to many investors might have been not the best way. You know, I think people assume too much liquidity in that asset class, which is inherently a not a liquid asset class at all. You see redemption requests really pick up over the past few months. You've seen them gated. You've seen pretty much almost any private credit fund you can name is either gated or in the process of gating right now. You've seen the terrible performance from BDCs where the public is assigning massive discounts to these portfolios on the public side, and sometimes, in some cases, on the order of 40 to 50% discounts to NAV.
The publicly traded.
Yes, the publicly traded part of private credit. And yet the private credit portion of these funds is marked at par, right? And recently you've seen some markdowns, right? You've seen some big names that a lot of private credit funds own that have been marked down. You've seen headlines about a private credit holding getting marked to zero from par all in a matter of like 3 weeks. I think you're going to see more of that. You're going to see more, particularly in the software space where there's just a ton of obsolescence potential from, you know, from AI, et cetera. And a lot of these loans were made 2 to 3 years ago when they're coming up for renewal. A lot of them have gone what we call PIK, payment in kind, which is essentially we can't pay you cash interest anymore, so we're going to pay you in the form of more securities. To me, that's a default.
Yeah, that's a shadow.
I like to talk about it as a kind of a payment. In the form of more debt, right? That's, you know, that's, well, I can't name companies, but that's a lot of companies have gone out of business doing that. Usually a PIK is the first sign. But, and that's the other problem. So you're seeing non-accruals rise in these both BDC and private credit portfolios. You're seeing percentage of PIK move straight up. You've seen the shadow default rate move straight up. So, you know, and this has all happened in the past like 6 to 9 months, and it's just getting worse. So, and I'm not trying to scare people. I'm really not. I'm saying this is reality on the ground. This is the result of a very aggressive underwriting cycle. And what this is what happens on the back end of it. You're seeing the first signs of it now. The good news for investors is they have a chance to diversify now, especially if they're in public markets, because if you decide to make an allocation change, you're doing it at all-time tight spreads in the public market. So how can you ever look back on that and say, boy, that was a terrible thing to do, right? No, you're maximizing your value proposition there. And on the private side, I understand why the queue for redemptions is massive for these things. I mean, you're going to continue to see headlines about this because people are like, listen, you know, I'm looking at the public BDCs and these things are trading at, you know, 15, 20, all the way to 50% discounts. This you have marked at par. I think that the fear is in there now and this is going to continue. And the thing I'm most fearful about with the private credit redemptions and the queue and everything else is, in some cases, they're funding these redemptions by opening credit lines. Like they're not even selling out of the portfolio or they're selling their most liquid stuff, which means what's left over is not the most optimal things that you would, or things that either can't be sold or you'll have a very hard time selling. Not to mention the insurance ties, the captive insurers inside many of these private credit firms, which is where a lot of these securities reside, automatic buyers basically.
Mm-hmm.
And where a lot of risk and leverage resides in these insurance companies. What I'm very worried about is any type of a bad headline that could cause a run by annuity holders or GIC holders on any one of these lesser capitalized insurance companies from a surplus standpoint that could then cut into that surplus, bring it down to a very low or unstable level, and then you get into potential problems with the insurance regulators, and then that's what happened a few years ago.
So there's some tail risk there potentially.
Yeah, 100%. It's something I've dug into very closely, and the deeper I dig, the more nervous I get. Because it's just like I said, you don't even need an event; all you need is a headline to get that process started, and that's what I'm just getting really nervous about. And as a fixed income guy, I'm supposed to be nervous, right? I got to make sure I get my money back every time I lend it out, and you know, lending money out to a single B-rated company at 300 basis points over treasuries right now does not seem like an optimal thing for me to do.
Yeah, and you know, when I talk to private or public credit investors, it's always about the downside focus.
It should be right now because the valuations are so rich, right? And on the private credit side, it's the opaqueness that you got to be fearful of. And in fact, the DOJ and others are looking into that, right? I mean, you've seen some compliance issues pop up, and it's probably going to continue in my mind. I don't see the headlines stopping. Let's put it that way, based on everything I'm seeing.
It seems to be a perception challenge. But at the same time, it's a $2.5 trillion space.
It is. It's
so
grown huge.
You're seeing opportunities on the secondaries market for managers that can evaluate some of the debts that are being sold.
Yeah.
Distressed debt market, special situations. So
yeah, there's even some BDCs that for like a retail buyer, I would say are worth buying right now. But you got to deal. The only reason I'm not is because I think public credit has a lot of catching up to do here. Like you're trading at all-time rich valuations. And I don't see an environment where BDCs can rally as public credit is fading, right? They'll go down less, but I just don't see, I don't see. The jaws need to converge at some point because you have BDC performance going straight down and yet public credit performance going straight up. The jaws are the widest they've ever been between those two lines ever in history. those got to close. I see them closing more by public credit catching up to the downside to some degree, and then BDCs turning up. So I'm just waiting for a slightly better entry point that I know is going to occur when public credit finally starts to catch up a little bit.
So if we zoom out a little bit now, we've got a new Federal Reserve chairman potentially coming in, almost certainly coming in.
Yeah,
Mr.
Warsh.
Based on the headlines, what are your thoughts around Mr. Warsh and how would that affect the rate environment going forward?
Yeah, well, I'll be honest with you. You know, the Federal Reserve, more recently, I mean, the credibility has been called into question to some degree. Is Kevin Warsh influenced by this administration? I mean, I can speak honestly. I think he is. I mean, I'm not going to sit there and say I don't think he is at all. He's truly independent thinker. I mean, he was appointed for a reason very excitedly by this administration. I know this administration wants to cut rates. I think that's a crazy idea in a 4% CPI environment with the economy not cratering. I do think there's some economic weakness ahead, and I haven't said that in a long time. I've actually been pretty constructive on this economy, but I'm also a small business owner. I see what's going on with the small businesses I own in terms of inflation fundamentals, in terms of employment costs, which continue to move up, in terms of, the economy overall, which seems to be plateauing and possibly, maybe rolling over a little bit, not a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking like deep recession or anything like that. Just seems to be rolling over.
Some softness.
Yeah, lower and middle income, I think, is really getting tapped out here, especially with these gas prices now.
And part of the K-shaped economy.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that worries me. And I'm seeing that real time, in one of my small businesses. I'm seeing the rising costs. I'm seeing the consumer slowing down. I'm seeing the unwillingness to pay up for certain things. So, some of the major retailers have actually come out and kind of confirmed that just even over the last couple of days. So it's between the inflation fundamentals, which I've been, it's funny, for the last 4 years, all I'm told is, oh, we expect inflation to fall. We expect it just doesn't, right? It just doesn't. In fact, now it's moving the other way. Do I expect energy prices to reverse at some point? Well, I hope so. I mean, $4.60 a gallon for regular unleaded, $5.50 for super, and that's cheap in some states. It's not affordable for a long period of time by most people, and it really cuts into home budgets. It cuts into everything. I mean, you walk out of a Costco right now with a basket full of goods, it's probably costing you 10% more than it did a year ago, and that's speaking very honestly. So I also think real inflation is understated to some degree, given the BLS inputs and everything else.
So hard to see a rate cut.
It's hard. I know they want
inflation.
To. I know they want to. I think it would be a huge mistake, for them to cut rates in a 4% inflation environment with the economy not, not going straight down. They probably cut too much already. I think you'd agree. If they could take back some of those cuts now, they probably would, or they probably would have a while ago. They cut too much too fast for the wrong reasons. So now here we sit at 3.5. Is that an appropriate neutral rate given where we are right now? To me, it is. Hmm. To me, it is. I don't know why you'd ever cut in this environment. And it's not restrictive. I mean, since when 3.5% years ago would have seemed extremely easy, right? I think people, and I think you'd agree with that, people got too used to zero rates, which was a huge mistake. By the way, the fallout from zero rates we're still suffering with today, right? So. And I think too many people want to believe that zero is the neutral rate, and they want to believe that rates are going to go back down to zero again. And I'm here to say I just exclude that possibility from your opportunity set.
That's the short-term memory.
Yes,
you've got a longer memory through a lot of
I've been through
dislocations.
So much. Yeah, exactly.
Maybe a war story of some opportunities that you've seen where you've been able to benefit.
Well, my favorite ever was 2008. I mean, that was just insane. When I watched high yield spreads go out to 2000, I was very conservatively positioned at the time. I'm like, this is like kid in a candy store stuff. I don't think you'll see that again, by the way. 2016 was exciting to me, and that's more akin to the environment I think we could very well see. Now, in 2016,
what was the environment in 2016?
So 2015 to 2016, you basically had the oil price shock. And at the time, 2015, spreads were very tight, very similar to how they are now. Spreads were very tight, close to record tights. Everything was fine. There's a lot of spending in the energy sector because people just believed like, you can't have too many oil wells. You can't have too much production.
Okay.
Right. Then all of a sudden, oil prices started, economy rolled over a little bit, not a lot. I mean, it wasn't terrible, but oil prices started cratering. Then the technicals caught up and oil prices, went basically to zero on the futures market. And so all these energy companies that had recently gotten capitalized had problems. The high yield market had a significant energy component. So those names just got hit really hard. And, I'm talking 10, 15, 20 points at a time. But then it carried over to the rest of the market. So perfectly good companies like, you know, the telecoms started getting hit like 5-10 points for no good reason, right? Just carry it, which is what I think is going to happen this time as well. And suddenly high yield spreads go from 300 to 1,000 over. Once again, kid in a candy store time, right? I was like, this is great. You know, I thought we might blow out to 600-700. Instead, we're going out to 1,000. This massive, massive supply shock of bonds and securitized investments and CDO-type structures targeting AI infrastructure, which, and my problem with that is that you've got these ultra long-term bonds in some cases, 20, 30, 50 years, running headlong into the GPU refresh cycle, because the whole concept of halo assets, you know, which is, you know, basically heavy assets, low obsolescence.
Okay.
Yeah, the data center itself might be that, the bricks and mortar, the pipes going in, but everything inside of it, the, you know, the GPU racks, the gigawatt rack, you know, the everything inside it has a very quick obsolescence level, you know, maybe one to four years. And yet these things are being depreciated on a 5 to 6 year schedule, which inflates earnings for a lot of these companies. And the other problem is to retrofit these things. Like you've got 10 to 16 gigawatt data centers that are stranded now, right? They're good for nothing. They were only built a few years ago. Right now they're stranded.
Yeah.
Because the cost to retrofit them is too much. What's to say that the $14 billion AI data center being built in, you know, in Saline Township right now, that just that deal just got done, who's to say that's not going to be obsolete by 2028? Estimates are it very well could be. So you've got 20, 30, 50-year bonds against that and a two-year refresh cycle where you're going to have to retrofit it at a cost of tens of millions of dollars. Mm. What's going to cover that?
As the technology is moving
right.
so
the,
fast.
I just have simple questions like that. How, you know, it's not like, you know, when fiber was going into the ground back in the boom in the late, I understood that. Like, at least that's not going to go. That's not going to go obsolete, right? And it did end up getting used. A lot of fiber companies went out of business. You remember those days, but at least it got used eventually. With these data centers, I just don't know. It's not that I'm negative on them. It's just I ask questions, and I'm just not getting appropriate answers that I want to hear about it. So we'll see where this goes.
We'll see how it plays out.
Yeah.
Bill, I hope we don't have a market dislocation anytime soon.
But, no one wants them, but sometimes they're necessary.
I appreciate you educating us on absolute return strategies, and it sounds like you're ready to capitalize if we do have a dislocation.
Yeah, we sure will. And if we don't, you know, we'll just do the best job over cash that we can.
Bill, thanks very much for coming on Alternative Realities.
Great.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
That was Bill Egan, head of the Absolute Return and Opportunistic Fixed Income Team at JP Morgan Asset Management. To all our viewers and listeners, thank you very much for listening to the Alternative Realities podcast. You can download our second quarter 2026 guide to alternatives on the JP Morgan Asset Management website at jpmorgan.com/GTA. And if you've not already done so, please subscribe to Alternative Realities on your favorite podcasting platform.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions in current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. JP Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of JP Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.